Records music and film series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs will show multiple short documentaries by local filmmakers, followed by an audience Q&A. There will be films about the Me Too movement, the Palindrome World Championship, an urban farm, the Oregon coast, and much more. Again, that's PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m. Coming up on One Land Many Voices, the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. At 10, Valley Views talks to the program manager at Edible Corvallis Initiative about environmental stewardship. We'll round out the hour with flashpoints from our good friends at KPFA in Berkeley. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground, interviews, documentaries, and real-time coverage of issues affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. You can become a member at kboo.fm and click on the word donate. And now, as promised, here is One Land, Many Voices.
All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that is Decisions from Outer National. And we have a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Richard Falk. Richard is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor in Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is also the former UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. We'll be talking about the new Israeli law declaring Israel the nation state of the Jewish people. Before that, we'll be talking with Ilan Pape on Israel's genocidal assaults on Gaza and the Israeli Jewish nation state basic law that was just passed and what it means for the Palestinian people and what it means for what's going to happen, what's happening in the world today. But I'm really pleased to open up the first part of the show because the first part of the show is featuring someone who I've talked to quite a few times over the years and who I always appreciate her insights, and it's Anne Wright. She's an activist and former ambassador, and she's joining us to talk about the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, good to hear you, man. Real good. let's jump into this. Give people a brief description. You know, you've been involved in this in the flotillas, and we talked about that a few months ago when they were just getting started. And one of the ships recently was part of the Gaza Flotilla bringing aid and support to the people of Gaza was just recently viciously and violently attacked and seized by Israeli military forces in international waters. What happened there? Give people a brief description of what happened there.
Yes, after a 75-day voyage starting in Scandinavia, two of our ships, the Al Alda and the Freedom, have been approaching Gaza. And in fact, on Sunday, the Al Alda, which is the faster boat, went into 49 miles off the coast of Gaza. It was violently boarded by the Israeli military, People were tasered. One fellow was tasered four times, another person two times in his neck and face. The captain was beaten up. The chief engineer was beaten up. A 69-year-old young woman, doctor, orthopedic surgeon, who's very well known in the UK, that must weigh probably 60 pounds. She was pushed around and broke two of her ribs. I mean, it was so totally outrageous and unnecessary. All of those people, the 22 on board Al-Auda, now have been, not only were they kidnapped in international waters, they were taken against their will to a country they did not want to go to, Israel. They were charged with entering Israel illegally and then deported from the country. Now all of them are at their home areas. Yet we have another ship, the Freedom, which is approaching Gaza right now.
Mm. And tell me this, because this will have repercussions for this other ship that's approaching Gaza. What happened initially happened in international waters. It wasn't in any territory that Israel can somehow lay claim to. Isn't that akin to piracy?
Indeed it is. And in fact, all of our ships from the last 10 years have all been in international waters. None of them have been even in the self-declared Israeli security zone, which extends outward from Gaza for 20 miles. All of our ships have been stopped well out of the 20-mile zone in international waters. And indeed, what the Israelis are doing to these ships qualifies as piracy.
Now tell people, again, just give people a good idea, a description of what the flotilla is and does. I think it's really important for people to understand that this wasn't a flotilla that was going in like with the cannons loaded and aimed at the shores. It was actually, this is a flotilla that had a certain mission it was on, and it got attacked in a very bad way. And actually in the past, one of the flotillas back, a number of years back, was actually the scene of a big slaughter or a basic attack by the Israeli military where guns were used against the people that were there.
Indeed, that was in 2010 when the Israeli oppression forces executed 9 people, wounded 50, and another one subsequently died. It was a bloodbath on unarmed civilians that were merely trying to bring attention to the Israeli illegal blockade of Gaza that is so harmful for 2 million people that live in this tiny little place called Gaza, where they're just being squashed to death by this the blockades that the Israelis have, blockades of food, blockades of people, and in the last 2.5 months with the great return march that the Palestinians in Gaza have been making to the fence line of the border with Israel, where the Israeli snipers have executed over 140 people and wounded hundreds and hundreds of them. Over 16,000 people have been injured or wounded by the Israeli snipers that just sit up there and just keep shooting people. And if they don't kill them, they aim for to maim them so that they will be injured for the rest of their lives.
Mm. Now, I understand that one of the people, when we're talking about what actually happens in the attacks on these, in the Israeli attacks on these ships and these caravans, one of the people that was on this ship was a man named Joe Meadows. Let's talk about why it's important for people to know this.
Yeah, Joe Meadows was our U.S. Delegate to the 2018 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. We selected him because he brings a very unique history. He was a survivor of the 1967 Israeli military attack on a U.S. Navy ship called the USS Liberty. And that attack in June of 1967 killed 34 U.S. Navy sailors and wounded 174 of them in a brazen attack of the Israeli military on a U.S. Naval ship. Mm-hmm. So Joe was with us, and this is the fourth time, actually, he's been involved in the flotillas. He was on the 2010 flotilla and was in Israeli prison. And then he's just emerged from the Israeli prison. And in fact, we'll be having a welcome home for him on Sunday in Corpus Christi, Texas, where he lives.
Now, one of the things, again, going back to the fact that this happened in international waters, not in somebody's area where they could claim that you were, that the ship was actually trespassing or moving in places where it shouldn't have been. Has there been any response? What has the response from the U.S. been, and or other governments about what's going on with this?
Well, the U.S., of course, always protects Israel no matter what criminal acts it commits. It protects them when they execute Palestinians. It protects them in the apartheid walls. It protects them in the illegal settlements. We did not expect at all that the United States government would hold Israel accountable for piracy in international waters, and they have not. Mm-hmm. It is pitiful, the protection that the United States of America gives to Israel, and that's what empowers Israel to keep doing all of these horrible things. If the United States would just say, we aren't going to give you any more money, I mean, we give Israel the highest amount of aid that we give to any country in the world, and yet it's a developed country, but we use Israel too. We use Israel, Israel becomes the testing ground, or they ask the Israeli military to test on Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, U.S. military weaponry, bullets, different kinds of bombs. So the Israelis, the U.S. is complicit with Israel in the real genocide of the Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza.
Absolutely. Now, let's have one more question for you. What are plans for other boats to continue this effort? Because I know there's more than one boat that was going in there. What are the plans?
Well, that's right. We have one that is fast approaching Gaza right now, and then we have two other boats that made the long trip from Scandinavia and are in the Mediterranean and are not part of this last part of the flotilla for a variety of reasons, one of them was damaged in a big storm off Sicily as it was sailing, and another one had some maintenance problems that we couldn't even move it from Sicily. So we do have two more boats that at any moment, as we get them repaired and when we decide the time is right, we can move them on to challenge that Israeli blockade, that illegal blockade of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Now, one last thing, Ann. How can people follow this on their own? How can they keep up with what's going on, with what's happening, and be able to know, like, if there's an attack, what they can do?
Surely. Well, we do have a website through the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition and Justice for Palestine that keeps it very up to date. We have a Twitter that's Freedom Flotilla. We've got all sorts of Facebooks that are up. So all you have to do is really Google Freedom Flotilla and lots of things will come up.
All right, Ann Wright, I'm sorry that it was such a short and quick thing, but it was very meaty, and I think people got a lot out of it, and we needed to talk about this, and we'll talk about it more in the future. So let's stay in touch with each other.
We shall, and thank you for supporting us. Thank you.
Definitely, and take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ann Wright. And Ann is, she was talking with us about one of the ships that was part of the Gaza flotilla bringing aid and support to the people of Gaza and how it was viciously and violently attacked and seized by Israeli military forces in international waters. And think about this, folks. The blockade of Palestine has of Gaza and Palestine has meant horrible suffering for the 2 million people of Gaza, an economic and humanitarian full-on crisis, okay? The UN has warned that the overall conditions in Gaza, the conditions that actually exist right now, could render the territory uninhabitable by 2020. Keep that in mind when you're thinking about what needs to be done, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children going to adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint and pray that red light.
All right, that was Desiri X with Checkpoint. We're going to move right along now, and I know that the person who's sitting on the other end of the phone line is just itching to get into this, and I've been itching to talk with him for quite a while. It's been a while since we've had a chance to sit down and talk, and I want to welcome to the show Ilan Pape. Ilan, welcome.
Thank you. Great honor to be on your show. Thank you.
Yeah, well, it's a great honor to have you, man. I always appreciate what you do in relation to this. And I should tell people that, you know, you are someone who's published 15 books on the Middle East, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, a book that had a major impact on my own view of what's happening in the situation. And you're the director of the European Center of Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. And just recently, you talked about how on July 19th, the Israeli government passed a new law announcing that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. And I immediately kind of thought after you looked at some things and I said, you know, this is an extremely dangerous move by the Israeli settler regime, and it could have terrible, even genocidal implications for the Palestinian people. Let's jump into this, okay? Right now, let's jump right into things. What is this? What is the Jewish nation state law, and what does it actually do?
Yes, first of all, the law itself is what we call in Israel a foundational law. Foundation law is almost like a part of a moving constitution. Israel doesn't have a constitution, so something which is equivalent to a constitution is a constitutional law or fundamental. Foundational law, which means it's very difficult to change it. So, and the second thing about foundational law is that they kind of radiate the ethos of the state, its vision, its strategy. So it doesn't only state what the state will do in the next year or two. It sort of charts a roadmap, if you want, an ethical roadmap for the future of the Jewish state. And this is why I think people are so alarmed by what this law is doing. It states basically that Israel, and it doesn't define the borders of Israel. It's very clear from the law that Israel can still expand, whether they mean by that over the West Bank or the whole of the West Bank, time will tell. But whatever will become Israel is a place where there will be two kinds of citizens. Those who are Jews, who will have all the rights, and those who are not Jews, primarily Palestinians, who have very limited rights. Now, to be honest, Palestinians, whether they are Israeli citizens or whether they live in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, never had equal rights with the Israelis. But it was never institutionalized in such a way. And the institutionalizing it, legalizing it in such a way, shows that either the Israelis are right by saying it's time to declare Israel an apartheid state because the world wouldn't care, or hopefully they're totally wrong and they went one step too far. The law also has some manifestation of this new apartheid law in terms of the right of the Jews to live in exclusive communities and not accept Palestinians, to the state would only support colonization by Jews, no building by the Palestinians, demotes the Arabic language that used to be a state language into a kind of a folkloristic language, and so on and so forth. So this is really, I compared it, I didn't do it in an article, but I reread the 1948 apartheid law of South Africa. If you remember, that's the way South Africa became officially an apartheid state in 1948 through a similar constitutional law. There are not that many differences, I must say. So the big question is the question that you said. Indeed, I mean, apart from the fact that it bodes, it's very ominous as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the really important question to ask is, are the Israelis right? Can they do it and not fear at all the international reaction? That's a big question.
Yeah, and doesn't that have something to do, though, like with actually what we're doing now, but also people being able to get the news and the understanding of what's happening here? Because I'll tell you, it's like, you know, when you talk to people about this, a lot of people will say things, especially people who know something about Palestine and Israel. They might say something like, well, look, really, how is this going to be different? It's just it's a matter of degrees. You know, isn't this already been going on in Israel, you know, in Israeli-occupied Palestine, you know? What's it going to do, you know? And then you're thinking about this, and even people who say second-rate citizens, which actually, you know, there's a big difference, it seems to me, between what this law is actually enforcing and the whole idea of some kind of milquetoasty second-rate citizens.
I agree. But I think there's something else which would be very interesting to follow. I think some of the people who are critical of Israel and know enough about the practices and the policies of Israel to say this is inhuman, this is brutal, this is not according to the proportion of what the Palestinians are doing. All these people who condemn an Israeli policy here and Israeli policy there, so somehow comfort themselves by saying, anyway, this will all disappear when a two-state solution will be there. So this is temporary. Israeli inhumanity or brutality is temporary because peace will allow them not to behave in such a way. What this law shows that this has nothing to do with the conflict. This has to do with the very nature of Zionism and the very nature of a Jewish state. The very idea of a Jewish state, and some of us have been saying it for decades, if you insist of having an ethnic Jewish state in the Middle East, it can only be in either a state that has removed by force everyone who is not a Jew, namely perpetual ethnic cleansing, if not genocide, or a perpetual apartheid state. The fact that Israel succeeded throughout the years to sell a different formula by saying, no, we can be both Jewish and democratic once there will be peace, I think this kind of fable has today disappeared. I think nobody would take it any seriously. So it would be interesting, especially for the Jewish communities around the world, to see how far are they going to have this knee-jerk support for Israel, when now Israel itself states clearly we are an apartheid state.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very interesting. The same happened, by the way, very interesting what's going on tonight in Israel. I'm talking to you from Haifa, where the Druze community, the community of Palestinians who were willing to collaborate with the state since 1948, going to the army, serving as the police in the occupied of the occupation and so on, they suddenly realize that this is a fundamental law. And it doesn't matter what they did for the Jewish state and all the horrific things they also did for the Jewish state, they are still in the apartheid system and not part of the nation. So they are going mad in their response because suddenly it hit them. The state is an ethnic Jewish state, and if you're not defined as ethnically or religiously a Jew, doesn't matter what you'll do for the state or how far you'll go with your collaboration, you will never be accepted as an equal person. And it's not just being an equal citizen, it's not being an equal person. And it's quite frightening, of course, to think that a group of Jews can think in such a way, act in such a way, even 70 years after, or more than 75 years after the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ilan Pappe. And Ilan is someone who's written, just voraciously written about what's going on in the Middle East, especially the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. He's a professor of history and the director of the European Center of Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter in England. And there's another question I had. There's a few more questions. And one is, actually, I think maybe I'll come back to it in a minute, but one is right off of what you've been saying. The significance of this statement that was taken from the nation-state law, and that is that the realization of the right to national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. That has a lot of, you know, a lot of meaning behind it that is not good.
There's a baggage there. Yes, of course. It's a clear statement by Israel. Forget about the two-state solution, or forget of any solution that has any respect, even a modicum of respect for the rights of the Palestinians for self-determination. I really think that it would be very interesting to see, because the international community, for good reasons and cynical reasons, it doesn't matter, and successive American administrations, including Bernie Sanders and Obama, supported the two-state solution, and they explained to us and to the world that the reason that there is a chance for such a solution is that there is a fundamental Israeli group that believes that also the Palestinians have the right for self-determination. Sorry, guys, this is over. I mean, we told you before there was never such a group of Israelis beyond the ones that you can put in a telephone booth. But here you have it black on white. This is really a kind of a final death blow to the already dead body of the two-state solution. It will also require from the Palestinians, I think, re-strategizing and redefining what the end game, as far as they are concerned, is now, given the fact that they have no one to talk to on the Israeli side about the two-state solution.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you say is that this, what's happening now, will mean that concretely for the Palestinian people, 60% of the West Bank will now be Israeli territory. This is going to have a huge impact on the Palestinian people. I mean, talk about creating a wandering nation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you can already hear two kinds of reaction from the Palestinians here on the ground. One, and it's not surprising, sort of saying, okay, this has been a failure. We have no chance of changing this. I mean, it's almost like a sense of defeat, because if that's what they are going to do, how are we going to change it? Who's going to help us? And so on, because the imbalance is so against us. But then you hear the younger generation, and we see them on the borders of Gaza, and we saw them in demonstrations all over the West Bank and inside Israel, who say, no, we are not. You can do all these things. You have all the power to unilaterally do these things, but you are sowing the seeds for a very long struggle, and we will continue in this struggle. And we hope that one day the Arab world will be with us, and the Islamic world will be with us, and maybe the good progressive forces in the world will be with us. I think that it's a very short-sighted view by Israel to look at the present balance of power and the dismal situation in the Arab world and say, oh, we have nothing to worry about. May I add to this also, see the Trump administration as a constant variable in our life, and therefore they have nothing to worry from that angle as well. I'm an historian. We know how quickly things change and how quickly imbalances of power are redressed. And I think that what this declaration, like the moving of the American embassy to Jerusalem does, it clarifies a reality that for some people was still blurred because of propaganda, fabrication, or wishful thinking. I think in the positive side of all of it is that it becomes what many of us have argued for years, unfolds now in such clarity that we are waiting for more people to do what we have done before, in not in great numbers, because we already saw it beyond the fog. And this is joining the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel, understanding that the only solution is a one-state solution. I think these ideas were marginal, are going to become center place now.
See, that's really important, and it's because I was actually going to ask you this thing. Look, there's a whole lot that goes on here, and this new law, which I understand supersedes many of the existing laws in relation to the character of Israeli society and the rights of non-Jews, and especially the Palestinians. And, this is an extremely dangerous situation. One, because of the nature of the law. Two, because you do have a monster like U.S. imperialism there. And three, they are actually, the U.S. is looking around, they're talking about war on Iran, and what significance would all this have for, like, this change in Israel, what would that add to the significance or what they're able to do in relation to Iran? And I keep looking at this and think about what they're doing. And to me, this is, and can only be called, I think, this is a fascist leap in what's going on in relation to Israel in that part of the world.
Absolutely. And I think that there was always a group of people in the United States who supported Israel as they would have supported any state during the Cold War, provided it was with the United States, regardless of whether it was a tyranny, if it was an autocracy, or even a rogue state. It didn't matter as long as it's our rogue state and not the Eastern Bloc's rogue state. But of course, part of the support for Israel comes from people who say, no, in this case, we're not supporting the rogue state, we're supporting the only democracy in the Middle East. And this ethos is the main reason why Israel is our blue-eyed boy in the region. Now, this is not going to work anymore as an explanation. In many ways, the whole notion of what American policy is based on, at least allegedly, I know that in practice it's not based on moral consideration, but at least the ethos that there is a moral dimension to American policy would be thrown out of the window if Donald Trump did not do it already with North Korea and other countries. It would be very interesting to see how you're going to maintain the special status of Israel within the American administration if this side of the issue, of this aspect of the support, is going to disappear. there are still the Christian Zionists who, of course, would say it doesn't matter because of their dogma. Whatever Israel does is okay because they are the chosen children of God who will convert anyway to Christianity in the end of the day. But I think that you're right. There's something fundamental there that can have also ripples and influence on the way the debate in the United States would unfold about regional policies here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have one more question, and I could spend the whole day talking with you, but we'll have to do that in the near future, okay? Let me ask you this one more question, because it's really important, I think, when people look at this and we see what's happened, you know, if you paid any attention to what was happening in Gaza over the last few months, you know, back in the spring and the whole mm-hmm. all the demonstrations, the people, I think, for the first time may have gotten an eyeful of and an understanding of what is happening, what is being done to the Palestinian people in Gaza. Let's talk about what all this will have, what meaning will it have, what impact will it have for the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Yes, I think that we are in a very crucial moment about Gaza. The Hamas and the kind of popular resistance there were hoping that a kind of a sustained civil disobedience, demonstrations on the fence would force the Israelis at least to remove some of the blockade and some of the siege that is imposed and makes it, as your former interviewee said, uninhabitable in the next few years. It seems that the Israelis are trying to play a game here by saying, okay, whenever they think that the Hamas is going somewhere, has some sort of a success, like sending these primitive kites into Israel that ignite some of the fields, don't kill anyone, but ignite some of the fields, they play the game of, okay, we'll remove some of the siege, and that should be okay. That's a strategy. You can live like this for years. I think the Hamas is now asking itself, are we able to live like this for the next 20 years? The Israel can live with it for the next 20 years. They don't care. Even if some of their own inhabitants very near to Gaza suffer from it, they don't care. This is a strategy. The big question is, what does the Hamas think? And what are the other parts of the Palestinian people are going to do in solidarity, given that this is what Israel offers to the people of Gaza, continued living in the ghetto, mm-hmm. With some easing of the restriction, but not basically changing the existential reality there.
Absolutely. All right, Ilan Pappe, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I look forward to talking to you again soon, man.
Yeah, inshallah, I hope so. Thank you.
Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ilan Pappe. And, you know, it's really interesting. Ilan is an Israeli-born author of 15 books on the Middle East, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He's a professor of history and the director of the European Center of Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. And he's someone who's always very sharp on his truth about what's going to go on, all right? That's what we need. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
At you. I know what you did and I know what you do. Flipping that news got the people confused. Abusing all the rhythm, leaving us the damn blues. Wicked while you're winning while the rest of us lose. Nobody knowing just who the f*** who. So I identify you. Those who know who.
That was Public Enemy with Those Who Know Who. And never forget that. On Thursday, July 19th, the Israeli government passed a new law proclaiming that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. This bill legally enshrines and heightens the racist oppression and the subordinate status of Israel's 1.9 million Palestinian citizens. It is, without question, one of the most outrageous and dangerous developments in the history of the Zionist regime. And here to talk with us about this is Richard Falk. Richard is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. and Richard is the former UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Human Rights. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy as always to be with you.
Yeah, good. Well, let's jump right into this because there's a hell of a lot going on and there's, you know, such tremendous things bound up with this. The latest movement by Netanyahu in Israel, in occupied Palestine, is a very dangerous development. You know, the idea that actually the Israeli government passed a new law proclaiming that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people, and it legally enshrines and heightens the racist oppression and subordinate status of Israel's 1.9 million Palestinian citizens. Without question, it's one of the most outrageous and dangerous developments in the history of the Zionist regime. What do you make of this, man? It's like, you know, all of a sudden it's sort of Netanyahu comes out and says, okay, this is what we're doing. This is where we're at.
Well, I think there are two big things to say about this. The first is that what this does is to give a legal face to a condition that had been factually present for quite a long time. But giving it a legal face removes any kind of pretension that Israel is a democratic state that gives equal rights to all its citizens, so that it is important in stripping away the legalistic illusions that protected a kind of legitimacy for Israel that was convenient for governments. And it is only because I think the Trump administration gives Israel the permission and the green light to move in this very blatant way towards proclaiming its true identity and the real consummation of the Zionist project that I believe existed from its inception, but unfolded step by step as the possibilities presented themselves. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that this kind of subjugation of non-Jews in Israel removes any controversy from the contention that was quite controversial up to a year or two ago, that Israel is a form of an apartheid state. And that apartheid is an international crime. According to the statute of the International Criminal Court, it's one of the types of crimes against humanity. It doesn't depend on it resembling South Africa. All it depends upon is one ethnicity or race subjugating another for the purpose of sustaining its domination. Mm-hmm. And I think these two developments are very crucial in removing any doubt about the nature of the Palestinian ordeal or the character of Israel's true intentions.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things I want to jump into right away is, you know, there's this thing about what does it mean, you know, when we're talking about this, what does it actually mean first for the Palestinian people? And when you look at this, what you were just saying, you know, this move by Israel, when Netanyahu made this whole, you know, announcement about this is, there's the nation state of the Jewish people and you know, this whole, everything that's packaged up in that, it formalizes in Israeli law the superior rights and privileges that Jewish citizens of the state enjoy and over the indigenous Palestinian minority who, you know, and actually the minority within Israel, that, you know, who, and they compromise 20% of the population, yet the law provides superior rights. It's not just a question of, well, we're just going to do this and we're going to do that, but there's actually an establishment of a whole ranking there that has been there but actually seems to be taking a leap.
No question. And that's why I think it is a dramatic development that deserves widespread recognition and denunciation. At the same time, Israel has for many decades discriminated between what it purports to provide citizens, including non-Jewish citizens, treating them with a kind of superficial equality, and its nationality laws that are very discriminatory, and they've been on the books for a long time, as many as 50 of these laws, and for instance, giving Jews anywhere with whatever, however superficial their contact with Israel, the right of return, while denying Palestinians, even if they have deep indigenous connections with Palestine, any right of return. So it as you say, it formalizes a situation that was embedded in the way in which Israel has been governed and the laws of Israel have been enacted for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, the focus on the Jewish character of the state that's emerged over these last couple of weeks, that focus on the Jewish character of the state, the religious character of the state, it's a very dangerous development in anybody's eyes, I think. Anybody who actually is open to and understanding what's actually going on and looking at what's actually happening on the ground there, it kind of opens up the door not just to this religious fundamentalism and what's happening with that, but it opens up the door to all sorts of horrors in the wake of that, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, and that's why I emphasize the apartheid nature of the Israeli state at this point being beyond responsible controversy. And that, of course, was considered when it was practiced in South Africa to be one of the moral scandals of the international community. So this is a very significant acknowledgement that the way in which Israel is unfolding is a crime internationally and morally unacceptable to any kind of perspective that values human rights. And it's not only a kind of religious claim, it's also a form of secular fundamentalism. And Netanyahu is not himself particularly religious. He's a secular Zionist with a very racist way of thinking about the Zionist project.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, I had spent some time in South Africa and wrote about it for many years, and you know, one of the things that I learned in the course of doing that was that in South Africa, there's, you know, if you're looking at like comparing South Africa and, you know, the Palestinians, it's actually, there's a question here that comes up because in South Africa, the Boers, the ruling racists, basically required the African people to be part of their production system. They required that.
Yes, and, their labor force.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, in Palestine, there's a different story there because it's not like they actually require nor want the Palestinians to be in that position.
Yes, that's a fundamental difference. A second fundamental difference is that Israel has always tried to maintain a demographic majority, and from its very origins, and that explains the integral relevance of the so-called Nakba, or the expulsion of up to 700,000 Palestinians, because it was the only way that a Jewish majority could be achieved. And all along, Israelis have been privately and sometimes publicly afraid of what they call the demographic bomb. Now, in South Africa, the white minority was the governing force, and they didn't pretend to be democratic at any point, and their legitimacy, to the extent it existed, was based on this ideology of separate development, which was really a different way of thinking about how people live together within a sovereign state. Israel has claimed to be a normal state with equal rights for all its citizens, and that's been the basis for claiming that it's the only democracy in the Middle East and so on. Now that claim is so undermined that almost no one to the left of Donald Trump would make such a claim at this point. Mm-hmm. It's an embarrassment to liberal Zionists who have taken the view that there's a way of solving the problem that will allow Israel to be a sanctuary for the Jewish people, but at the same time give a just solution to the Palestinians. And the whole two-state mantra or consensus was based on that assumption, but that's long since been undermined by the settlement process. Jewish settlers now are over 500,000. It's clearly an irreversible process. So the only outcomes can be either one state that is giving human rights to all, or an apartheid Jewish state. There's no realistic possibility of a two-state solution at this stage.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that gets me, though, is that I agree with what you're saying, and I also think that, you know, there's an element here of what I think is, it's pointing to it a lot more, is this ethnic cleansing in terms of the Palestinian people. And it's been going on, a lot of people would say, since the establishment of the State of Israel. I mean, that is what actually drove, you know, when they drove so many Palestinians out of Palestine and then declared it to be Israel and the homeland of the Jewish people. But, you know, there's a whole thing going on there of this sort of continuing, either sometimes, you know, straight on and hitting hard, and sometimes just in the background and hovering there. But the idea of ethnic cleansing in terms of the Palestinian people and what that means right now today.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been, as you say, it's been a process that has started in the 1948 war. And as I said earlier, it was connected with the essential goal of the Zionist project to have a majority Jewish population. And as you know, when the UN passed the so-called partition resolution in 1947, the Jews were a minority in their own portion of historic Palestine. And the only way they could attain the kind of legitimacy they wanted for to be a modern state was to drive out Palestinians. So ethnic cleansing was integral to the Zionist notion of political legitimacy from the beginning, and they thought of that as essential for joining the UN and for the support of the liberal democracies of the West, particularly the US. So this issue of ethnic cleansing is not something marginal or something that could be altered. It's fundamental to the whole way in which the Zionist project has been conceived and enacted over time.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things, I know we've talked about this somewhat before in other times when we were talking with each other, but there's this point that makes this really come alive in a very horrifying way and current in terms of what's happening in Gaza. You know, and that to me, when you look at what, you know, this is just something that I'm always astounded that somehow the Zionists have been able to just keep pushing this through with, and they're doing it with the backing of the U.S. and various other powers. But the idea that there is a genocide occurring on the Palestinian people in Gaza, and it's almost like, you know, it becomes sort of just a matter of fact and not something that's like so horrifying that people all over the world are standing up and demanding stop this. And the Israelis, you know, they're basically, their thing is, look, we're the victims. You know, these guys, they're throwing exploding rocks at us, you know, things like that. And they justify the most savage pillaging of both the territory, but the people themselves.
Yes. I mean, you have to put the demonstrations at the Gaza border that have been so brutally repressed, with live ammunition being used against mainly unarmed demonstrators, you have to put that together with this nation-state law. And it not only is the apartheid nature of Israel being disclosed, but also its dependence on violence to maintain its dominance. And I think of this recent set of atrocities at the Gaza border to be an equivalent, actually worse than what happened at Sharpeville in 1960 in South Africa, and was the tipping point, I believe, for international public opinion. It removed any shadow of a doubt about the nature of the apartheid regime. And I think the combination of the nation-state law and the violence at the Gaza border removes a similar kind of doubt and will be very influential with the mobilization of public opinion and increasing intensity of the BDS campaign and other initiatives that are recognizing the illegitimacy of the way in which Israel is governed at the present time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Richard Falk. Richard is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And Richard is also the former UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Human Rights. You know, one of the things that I couldn't agree with you more, and it's like one of the things that comes up all the time for me is when, especially in light of what's been going on in Israel over the last month and a half or so, and in that area over the last month and a half, you know, you look at this and you have this whole new, you have this new basic law which legally supersedes Israel's founding Declaration of Independence and all the other laws. But then when you're looking at that, there's no pretense left. It drops even the pretense of equality for all citizens, and it represents, you know, not just sort of an extension of what's been going on, not just sort of a, well, we're gonna expand it, we're gonna do whatever. It actually, to me, it represents a very dangerous fascistic leap.
Yes, well, it's hard to know at this point, I think, whether it's really just a legal reinforcement of a de facto situation that had been evolving in recent years, particularly in the Netanyahu years, or, as you say, it really is an intensification of this dynamic and makes life intolerable for the 20% Palestinian minority. And as you know, there's a significant portion of the Israeli population that would like to have a form of population transfer to eliminate or at least diminish the presence of Palestine within the territorial boundaries of Israel, which incidentally haven't been defined. Israel's the only state in the world that withholds a delimitation of its territorial boundaries.
And tell us the significance of that.
Well, I think it's a way of conveying the fact that the Zionist territorial project has not been fully consummated. Now, what that means, whether that means the formal incorporation of the West Bank, and they've already incorporated Jerusalem, and it probably means from this kind of right-wing view, the detachment of Gaza. See, they don't want Gaza. It has no, it's not part of the so-called promised land of biblical entitlement. They would like either Egypt or Jordan to take over the administration of Gaza or even absorb it into their own territory, which neither state is prepared or willing to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, building on this, sort of building Jewish-only settlements on occupied territory, which is what's being raised with this new law in Israel, you know, they talk about the national value of that, you know, and I thought that was really, in relation to what you're talking about, the ongoing sort of, you know, the idea, what the Israeli regime is looking to conquer in relation to, and build a greater Israel, you know, the lands, the territories that they're willing to conquer, they're trying to conquer and build a greater Israel in that part of the world. You know, you look at this, this is a very important thing when they talk about building, what is it exactly they say, building Jewish-only settlements on occupied territory is a national value. And to me, that raises the specter of something we've been talking about for a while, ethnic cleansing.
I completely agree with that, and it uncovers what I call the original sin of Zionism, which is to establish a Jewish-only state in a non-Jewish society. See, and that from that premise, all of these other crimes and wrongdoing has flowed, because in the age of decolonization, there's no way a people will accept that without trying to resist. And if they resist, there's no way to establish that kind of regime except by repression. So the repression is intensified because Zionism, as I suggested, also wanted legitimacy by being a majority Jewish state, and that meant you had to get rid of a lot of the people living there, which implied ethnic cleansing. So these crimes are all embedded within that commitment to this original, what I'm calling the original sin of Zionism.
Now, I have one more question for you, Richard. This, you know, and I was thinking about, you know, I was going back and forth, and I keep thinking about what we've been talking about and how even this one Arab legislator said that the move that's currently happening in that part of the world is actually the official beginning of fascism and apartheid. And then I stepped back for a minute and thought, okay, well, it's not just that, because there's also the role. There's a potential genocide, and there's the development of a whole new scene and strategy in the region, and that can't happen without the U.S. and what the U.S. is actually doing there, the support for Israel, but also backing it up in terms of and Israel serving, you know, the U.S.'s military watchdog role, and what that happens in terms of, you have, when you think about this, you have the U.S. there, you have the Christian fundamentalists worldwide, you know, shining their lights on Israel and what's happening there, and then you have all this happening, and they're pointing to what? They're actually talking more and more. And they're even trying to bring in the Russians, to a certain extent, or who knows what's going on there. But you have this whole thing going on where it all fits into the possibility of waging a war against Iran, and somehow the sort of molding together this particular part of the world, and in particular, the new Israel in relation to a major U.S. outpost there.
Yes, I think your analysis is compelling, and unfortunately, there's no really convincing alternative explanation. Whether one characterizes it as fascism or not is a question that can be discussed. I mean, depending on how one conceives of fascism, and it certainly has similarities to the fascist emphasis on racial superiority and on territorial expansion, aggression, militarism. All these features are certainly present there. Whether that terminology helps mobilize awareness or is diversionary, I think, is a question that can be discussed at some reasonableness. But I think what you point to is a very frightening set of tendencies, and they do focus in the near term on confronting Iran and risking a regional war as a consequence of that confrontation.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard, is there anything else you'd like to say to people on the basis of all this?
Well, I think it's a time for responsible people to finally shed the illusions about a diplomatic outcome and to support the efforts of people around the world in civil society to mobilize opposition to these developments that have made the life of the Palestinian people a modern nightmare that has gone on for far too long. So I think there's a responsibility and an opportunity for civil society to do what governments and the UN have failed to be able to do, to build an international movement that will oppose these developments that expose the apartheid nature of the Israeli state.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard Falk, as always, it's been a pleasure talking with you, man.
My pleasure, Michael. Take care.
Okay, you too. This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Richard Falk. Richard is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and Visiting Distinguished Professor in Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the former UN Rapporteur on Palestinian Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. We've been talking about the new basic law declaring Israel the nation state of the Jewish people.
And that brings us to the end of another show. I'd like to thank my guests, Anne Wright, Ilan Pape, and Richard Falk. I also want to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Lupe Fiasco and Break the Chains. Talk to you again next week.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. But if I work it one more day, I might just break the chains.
Join me every first and third Friday from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. We will ease your troubled mind with licensed mental health counselor Cheryl Jefferson, political analysis provided by the Prophet of Rage, and calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues, musicologist Professor Soul. From the Grassroots, I'm your host, Lanita Duke, on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Effect on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block in Portland. Effect is a two-day conference that examines the work, culture, and design of social change. This grassroots event featuring stories from multiple marginalized activists, creators, and technologists working towards social change. Again, that's Affect on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon, White Stag Block, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's about 10:01 in the a.m., which means we're going to be hearing Valley Views in a moment, talking to the program manager at the Edible Corvallis Initiative about environmental